So it's my pleasure tonight to introduce our speaker, Professor Eduardo Romuald. Eduardo has focused his research on how plants respond to harsh environments. He began his research at the University of Toronto in 87, continued that here in UC Davis since 2000. During the past decade, Eduardo and his colleagues have made important contributions to the field. They engineered salt tolerance by manipulating naturally occurring protein, sodium protein, proton antiporter. Also, drought tolerance, working on manipulating hormone biosynthetic pathway genes. And his interdisciplinary team studies molecular, cellular, and physiological mechanisms associated with senescence and tolerance, drought, and salinity. Eduardo studied at Hebrew University and got a joint degree, or jointly earned his degree from Energetics from Hebrew University and UC Berkeley. He's received numerous honors and awards, published over 140 articles, including articles in Science and Nature Biotech, and has received 7 patents. He and his wife Angie have 3 children, including his young budding tennis star Jake. And tonight, Professor Blumwald will update us on his continued research on the identification of stress tolerance traits and development of new drought-tolerant crops useful for agriculture production in the area in areas of the world with scarce irrigation and salt-damaged soils. So, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your invitation. It's great to be here. And I'm very grateful to you that you stay after the food, which is great. So I think this is a great idea, the fact that we can talk and we can talk with students and we can talk staff and industry and exchange ideas is just great. I think we need many more forums like this. So it would be nice if we can meet weekly, bi-weekly, not necessarily monthly. Particularly if there is food. So I feel like in jail with all these slides, so I'm sorry if I play with my eyes a bit. I really don't know you all, so I don't know what you know and what you don't. So I decided to take sort of an average knowledge. If sometimes I go above, I'm sorry. If I go below, I'm sorry. I'm doing my best. But essentially, I would like to bring you the story of how we decided to go for trying to engineer drought-resistant crops. And there is a little bit of another story at the end. I will try to put it together. I only have 132 slides, so we're going to be until 11 p.m. So, how we came to this. You can read that, so I will tell you the story. Essentially, when you look at evolution, during hundreds of millions of years, plants evolved a strategy of avoidance of stress. When stress comes, what plants do? Well, with this drought in particular, what plants do, they try to minimize the area of evapotranspiration. Minimize water loss. So what they do? Well, they drop leaves. They drop as many leaves as they can in order to get some of the seeds up in order to warrant the continuation of the species. And that is an incredible, intelligent, great survival strategy. Well, we are talking about plants in general, but we are not talking about plants. When we talk about crops, we don't talk about plants that evolve for hundreds of millions of years. We're talking about very young plants that actually we modify. We bred maybe 10,000 years, some even less, in order to produce. So here, we never really bred for stress tolerance, because we want more. And if a crop starts dropping leaves, forget it, because we depend first in yield and then we consume, society, progress, and etc. And costs, we need rotation. So we don't want plants that drop leaves. We need sources that can feed the sinks. The old leaves are vital for that because they contain potassium, they contain proteins, they contain phosphate, nutrients, and even water that we cannot lose. So our idea was very, very simple. What if we engineer the plant such that these old leaves or the older leaves, which are the sources, when they perceive stress, they remain in the plant. They don't drop. They don't upsize. That senescence induce, stress-induced senescence in the plant can be minimized. And to do that, well, we all know that cytokinin is a very important hormone in that sense, that if you apply cytokinin, you are delaying senescence. So we decided, okay, let's engineer the plant, let's put a gene there that codes for IPT, which is the critical enzymatic step in the production of cytokinin. And let's do it in a way that is induced during senescence. Well, that idea is not new, really. The first paper trying to do that was in 1978. They were not talking about stress, they were talking about senescence, lettuce and things like that. But nonetheless, this idea that, gosh, so many people tried, didn't work very well. And why didn't work very well? Essentially, here is what you have is just a picture where I show the sources and the sinks, and then the sources and the sinks. You have a very dynamic relation between source and sink. A leaf that is a sink now will be a source later, till the most important sink, the grain, or the seed of the fruit. When we do agriculture, we only grow sinks. That's what we harvest. The problem is that if you instruct these leaves to not senesce, these leaves are not going to send up the nitrogen, potassium, phosphate that during degradation they gradually send, sending the signals for flowering and development to the sinks. In a way, what you have is what is called the source-sink inversion. And that was a problem that almost all of the attempts to engineer cytokinin production in plants faced the source-sink inversion. These plants, these leaves, do not want to senesce. They feel very young. They do not degrade the protein, and therefore no protein is coming up. There will be no development. And if you are a farmer, and many of you are, and suddenly flowering is delayed for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, well, you will have to sell your farm because you cannot rotate. And that's terrible. So what we decided is, well, can be done, but we have to do it in a way that we engineer this to respond to stress and not during senescence, but during maturation, before senescence. When you are now in the process of senescence, it's too late. That process started and it's going to end. So you have to do it before. And we start looking for promoters like that, and we find one, PSARC, because it's an essence activate receptor kinase, just a kinase. We didn't care what the gene do. The only thing we wanted is a promoter, because this promoter, it's really activated during maturation, before senescence, and not only in the old leaves, but in every leaf. Second, we hoped that this promoter will be also stress-induced. In fact, what we did is we try first to be sure that the promoter is stress-induced because we want to avoid also the transgene effect. Many times you put the promoter there and you get an effect on your yield. You want those promoters to act when you need it, not before, not after. And essentially self-regulated because this is activated. They produce cytokinins. Cytokinin reduces the signal and reduces the expression. It's a self-regulated process. And We published this in 2007, 4 years ago now, and you can see clearly here what we did if we grew tobacco plants. We closed the greenhouse for 15 days and we left. Nobody touched the plants for 15 days. We came back, we watered the plants for a week, and this is the difference we got. I don't have to explain the difference. They are absolutely outstanding. Please remember, this is in a greenhouse, and almost everything works in the greenhouses. Almost. Then we went to rice, and here we just published this 4 months ago, and what you can see here nicely is that we get expression at the reproductive stage. I don't have to tell you, you know, when you're talking about cereals, the reproductive stage is the critical stage of the plant. Critical. If you get hit by any stress at the reproductive stage, you lose zillions. And actually, that is one of the sources of losses, millionaires' losses in corn and other cereals in the United States, the reproductive stage. You can see nicely that during stress is also induced at the third day, and you can see that it's induced progressively from bottom to top, fourth leaf, third leaf, second leaf, and the flag leaf nicely during development. Our experimental design is very simple. We are very pragmatic. We believe that there is a deficit in breeding for years, that really breeders never breed for yields, just for quality. And that is a big problem. And if you really want to deal with yields, you have to be aware what are the developmental stages, the more impact on yield. And in this case, we are talking about flowering stages, reproductive stages, anthesis. So what we did generally is that we apply droughts or at the pre-anthesis stage or at the post-anthesis stage. We just stop watering the plants. This is in the greenhouse. We start watering the plants until we see stress symptoms in the transgenic plants. Because the wild type is suffering, starts suffering way, way before. We wait until the transgenic plants start, for in case of rice, rolling of the leaves, then we rewater. And you can see here what happened. When they are well watered, there's no difference. When it's water stressed, you can see the transgenic plant here, the wild type here. When we use rewater, you can see the difference. You can see that the photosynthesis is really affected in the transgenic plant, in the wild-type plant during stress, but not in the transgenic plant. I don't want to discuss these parameters right now. And let's go to yields. Well, you can see it clearly here. The yields at pre-stress, at pre-anthesis, at post-anthesis, there is a yield penalty, of course, but there is less penalty when you compare to the wild-type. With these plants are really kaput. They produce very, very little. What about homeostasis in steady state? Can you really affect one gene and expect that the plant is going to show just one single change? Particularly when you're talking about plant growth regulators and hormones, there's no way. You touch one, you touch all. Why this is important? Well, this is important because when you're talking about yield, now maybe you would like to start combining the genes that you touch in order to program that plant for that particular variety. For example, we know that certain hormones will affect carbon mobilization much better than others. So you can give a priority, for example, to Brazilian steroids and not to, I don't know, something else. It's depending on your crop, and that will change. But for example, it's very clear cytokinin is changing. Please, I don't want to go. We published this, and just I was trying to show you that things change. How you read this? This is a wild type. The first two. This is well water and water stress. Transgenic, well water and water stress. Red means increasing gene transcription. Green, decrease in gene transcription, goes up or goes down. And you can see, I hope if you are not colorblind, you are going to see greens and reds. It happened. It happened many times. We are going to see, particularly among the male population, but you can see greens and reds clearly with cytokinin, CK. There is a huge red thing here in the transgenic plant. The biosynthetic pathway is changing. We have more. And with ABA, the stress hormone, you are going to see something very neat, that actually if this is a wild type, this is a transgenic, they are much less sensitive to stress. They don't feel the stress. They produce much less ABA. And if you go to Brasino steroids, you can see the big differences between the greens and the reds. And Jasmonic, those are the genes related to Brasino steroid biosynthesis. Many of these genes we have isolated, and we are transforming one by one. We believe there is a lot of power in Brasino steroids for seed filling, and Jasmonic and salicylic and oxygen gibberellins and ethylene. The concept here is you cannot expect changing a biosynthetic pathway of a plant growth regulator and expect that the other ones are not going to change. And you have to be very ready for that. Okay, I'm going to start showing now very strange graphs. And those graphs, believe me, I will show you a graph that took us to prepare the slide alone 4 days. Imagine the experiments. It took 3 years. And it's only one slide of those. But essentially what I'm showing here is enzymatic activity, gene expression, and also metabolomic data. This is what you call a systems biology approach, where you bring all the omics together. Towards the end, I would like to convince you that although expensive, it's very, very worth it. At the end. But in the meantime, I will not bore you with all these details. This is unpublished, actually, but I would like to show you what happened in rice during stress in the transgenics and the wild type. And essentially, this is what happened. The left is the black is the wild type. The white is the transgenic. And what you can see clearly is that the wild-type plants are producing more glucose and fructose, more sucrose and fructose from sucrose. I don't know if you know about sugars, but from sucrose, you can make two sugars, fructose and glucose. And if you do that, well, from one osmomol, you make two osmomols. The wild-type plant is suffering drought stress, water deficit. What it's trying to do is to compensate osmotically by using the sucrose to produce two molecules of solutes, glucose and fructose. It's not helping too much because, on the other hand, the transgenic plant, what it's doing is keeping the sucrose going, thank you very much, and you can see what happened with starch. There is more starch being produced in the transgenic plant because sucrose is not compromised. There is no osmotic challenge. I hope that is clear. I hope I'm not confusing you. And if you look at the enzymes, these little squares here are gene expression. The first two are the wild type, well water stress, transgenic well water stress. When you see red, means it's going up. The other thing that was very important for us is to discover that in rice, transgenic during stress, two enzymes, SPS and SUSE, are still active. There is sucrose production in the seed, which is very, very interesting. And also in the flag leaf, not in the seed, in the flag leaf, which is very interesting. Why we expect that at the flag leaf, when everything has to go up, well, the sucrose has to come from other leaves, but not in this case, which make us think about this carbon engineering, which is also related to nitrogen usage, as I will show you later. And you can see neatly that starch is being produced, and alpha amylase, critical for starch degradation, is green in the transgenic. It's going down. They are keeping more starch. Remember, the only reason we grow rice is because you want starch. Remember that, just in case. So, and you can see here, forget this, you can see more starch, but the most important thing is, look at what happened with the starch in the grain. This is the harvested rice grain. We end up with 30% more starch in the grain. This is what you are going to sell, which is very neat. Starch degradation pathway, just to show you, down means down-regulated. This is real-time PCR and fits very well with the array. You can see that all the genes involving starch degradation in the transgenic plants are going down, meaning they don't need sucrose. They can still do the produce starch and not degrade it, which is great. This is just to compare. Oh, God, it will take me hours to explain that. You know what? When they are very close, there is no difference. This is when you have to compare many, many different treatments altogether statistically. It's called spider web analysis because it looks like a spider web. When they are like that, means that they are different, and you can see this is the wild type, and this is transgenic, and you can see difference in sucrose, starch, glucose, phosphate, energy, fructose, ammonium, there's not too much difference, but look at nitrate. And I will, you know, we are essentially physiologists using every single discipline in the book to get our answers. We do molecular biology, biochemistry, and whatever you want. And what we want really is try to understand the carbon and the nitrogen used in the plant. Because at the end, what you want are proteins, and you need both sugar and both nitrogen. And nitrate is very much higher in the transgenic plant. But we didn't put more nitrate. Are they using it better? Well, we can go and see that. And this is a slide that took us 4 days, and you can see why. Each thing here is one experiment done 6 to 9 times. Believe me, this is a mess. And but essentially here, and this is really the basis of when we talk about system biology, when you put all the omics together, essentially try to find an answer. And how can we find the answer? Because for our surprise, what we are seeing is more yield during stress, more sugar assimilation, but more nitrogen utilization. It's almost too good to be true, yeah? This is great, but why? It's very important to know why, because in the greenhouse, everything works. We have to be prepared when we go to the field, because in the field, epistasis, interaction of other stresses, things don't work the way we should know why. And then, let me simplify this. Sugars. One thing that I will just tell you, you believe me, is essentially all of this, which is glycolysis, and the Krebs cycle is working wonderfully in the transgenic plant. And you can see because it's red, 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 and you can see the columns up, up, the white, 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 up. But it's not working very well in the wild type. Why? Well, one of the things which is interesting, that in this step, which is 2-oxoglutarate, is going up. And why 2-oxoglutarate is so important? For the oldies, this is alpha-ketoglutarate. 6 years ago, they decided to change the name. I never knew why, but they decided to change the name. Now it's 2-oxoglutarate. I like alpha-ketoglutarate, but nonetheless. So why is this so important? Because this is one of the links between carbon usage and nitrogen usage in the plant. And let's see how it is working. It's working because essentially you can see that there is a lot of nitrate in the transgenic plant. There is not too much difference in ammonia, although lesser in the transgenic plant. And GS and GOGAT, you guys understand what I'm saying? I am sorry because I am talking to the average. Those are enzymes. I'm assuming you know about nitrogen usage. Say yes, please, because if not, you kill me now, please. Say, you do that, and it's it. But essentially, these steps are critical for the assimilation of nitrogen.
And what happened is that GDH, this enzyme here, is very, very high in the wild-type plants. This is the point of this function in which 2-oxoglutarate is assimilated, and you can see nicely that nitrate and nitrite reductase are working very well, so well that the plant has a lot of nitrate to use. It's much more efficient doing it. This is a fit. The plant is very fit under stress. It's not even feeling the stress. But what happened in the wild-type plants? Because there is ammonia here. And where is that ammonia coming? And this was puzzling for us because, okay, it's rice, there is always ammonia, but why? Where is it coming from? Well, we went one step further and we decided to analyze all of the amino acids. You know, proteins, you need amino acids to make it. And what we found? Okay, look at the little arrows red. In all of the amino acids, with no exception, are very high in the wild-type plant, but they are very low in the transgenic plant. Why? Because they're making more protein, the transgenic plant, while the wild-type cannot make protein. That's where the ammonia is coming, from protein degradation. So we went and we measured, and you can see, I will show you after a combination of salt and drought, but you can see much more protein in the transgenic plants, the red and the yellow, and you can see much higher protease activity in the wild-type plants, more protein carbonylation that indicates the damage of the protein. That's where the ammonia is coming. The wild-type plants are eating themselves. Not producing protein, producing a lot of amino acids, which are useless because they don't go to protein. And I hope I made my case on this, but you have to believe me. When you go to the field, one of the things that we discovered the really bad way, when we went with our nice transgenic plants and one day of heat, wind, and the plants die on us. In the field, things don't go so rosy. There's very low humidity. Sometimes the soil concentration contains, the soil mix contains salts because the water is disappearing and the concentration was up. So we decided to start measuring combination of stresses. And in this case, I'm doing salt and drought together. I have to say that my former postdoc, now a professor in Israel, Tzvi Pelek, he went medieval in these plants because you will not expect 120 millimolar on rice. 25, 30 millimolar will be enough to produce a stress. He went just too high. But nonetheless, when he watered with salt after the vegetative stage, oh, look at the yield. It's great. Rice is sensitive at the seedling stage. Salt, it's not sensitive at the reproductive stage. Drought is different. Now, when you try to see how many genes are changing, just to show you, these and these look very similar, yes? Well, this is well water, and this is stress, and this is a transgenic plant. These and these look very different. And this is a wild type, and this is a wild-type stressed. So stress in the wild-type plants is really changing a lot of genes, but it's doing very little in the transgenic plants because the transgenic plants are not feeling the stress. That is the key of our invention. And when you see the genes in drought, well, there were around 1,000 genes changed in drought when you compare transgenics versus wild-type, 3,000 in the salt. How many are in common? Yes, somebody, students. How many are in common? Salt and drought. Little, more? Say something. More. You lose. Look at that. Between 4,000 genes, only 96 are common. And we were very surprised for that. And now we are doing intense analysis trying to understand how pathways come together, but also the concept of epistasis, how far can we go with that, particularly with plants growing in the field. So we went and we combined salt and drought and more physiological conditions. What we did is we grow the plants, and when they are at the four-leaf stage, We just started doing salt, 25 in molar, all the way until harvest. That is quite enough. A chicken soup, if I make it, is around 16 millimolar. So 25 is around the chicken soup. It's a lot of salt, actually. No, really. And you can see the hills, salt alone, a big heat, salt and drought. We get only a 25% penalty, 26% penalty, and when we combine them, we run between the 50 to 60% yield, around 30 to 40% penalty. Not bad. If you compare this with this, or this with this, we still are making a good yield. In the greenhouse, as I said, everything works in the greenhouse, almost everything. What happened in the field? So let me show you just very fast. In this case, we did peanuts. And the reason we did peanuts is the following. We tried to do field trials in Davis. And you know what? We have a problem. It's very expensive for us. We cannot afford it. Companies are used. They have the tractors and the people and the gauchos in the field. And it's easy for them to do it. For us, it's just a misery. You know, you get guys from the bench to the field and you fail. It's terrible because it's true. And it's very expensive. So what I decided is very simple. Where there is a lot of drought? California, Texas, wow. It's a lot of drought there. I have a friend there, Hong Shang. I phone him. You know, we play chess a lot, so many times. I said, Hong, you have to help me. He transforms peanuts and cotton. I gave him the gene, transformed peanuts and cotton. We went to USDA in Lubbock. They did the field trials, and they didn't charge us for us. It's just for the paper. And you can see something. Yeah, because if not, they charge you. But you can see something nice in the field. This is photosynthesis and stomatal conductance. You can see something. Physiologically, the four lines, 3, 7, 11, and 13, lines of transgenic peanuts are doing better. When you go and you... And now this is a nitrogen connection, which is very interesting. When you look and you see the pods of the wild-type plants, they have two seeds each. You need a lot of nitrogen to make pods and to fill the seeds. When you go to the transgenic plants, they have more pods with 3 and 4 seeds. So we quantify the difference. Well, look at the difference. More pods with 3 seeds, more pods with 4 seeds. You can see here the difference between the plants and the pods. These guys are using nitrogen better. There's no doubt. And then we did 2 field trials. In 2009, we have a massacre with the irrigated plants. They were attacked by something. We still don't know what it is. They chew all the plants. Terrible. But nonetheless, you can see in dry land what happened in the field trial. But you can compare nicely what happened in 2010 in the field when it's irrigated and when it's not irrigated. If you are a medium farmer in Texas, you cannot irrigate your peanuts because the water is so expensive, you don't make a penny. You have to understand that there's no irrigation. If it rains, last summer has been terrible. No plants anywhere. But you can see nicely that the wild-type plants take a huge heat of 62% average yield penalty, while one of the lines, for example, took only a 30% penalty. This is double the yield. Dry land in the field. We went and we did also cotton in Texas. This year, the cotton was like this. Amazing. There was no water whatsoever. I think that during the season, there was something like 14 millimeters. So we did another field trial in 2011, but it's terrible. But nonetheless, in 2010, you can see nicely photosynthesis, stomatal conductance, transpiration in the transgenic lines, and look at the yield data. Significant, very significant increase, both in the ball number and the fiber yield. This is gram per plant. And we are talking really a very... I don't know, guys in industry, I think, will appreciate that. It's more than 6%, much more. Okay, what are we doing now? essentially what we are doing is we are combining, because we have traits for water use efficiency, I can show you now. We have for salt, we have some for heat stress. Now we are combining genes and see what happens. We are using as a system Brachypodium, which is a very good model for rice and wheat. And it's very easy to transform, it's very easy to grow, to propagate. With the limitations we have in the university, it's a great plant for us. And, of course, we are doing the same PSARC with IPT, but we have also a new promoter with a bunch of new genes, and we're doing a lot of combinations for wheat and rice and also for alfalfa. With alfalfa, we have a new project. We are actively collaborating with the guys from Alan Bennett's lab, PIPRA, CC here, trying to get not only drought tolerance, but more and higher protein content in alfalfa, which is a plant with more protein from all the crops that we grow. Okay, the lecture should finish here. But I wanna, can I take another 5 minutes from you? You cannot say no now. I've been so polite. Come on, just 5 minutes. Because you know what? We talk about omics and omics and omics and omics and omics and omics. And whenever we pass you a bill of omics, the industry just goes, they go for cock. They say, what? So expensive? How many genes you have to know? But what can you do with that? And I have a nice example to show you the power of omics. May I? 5 minutes, more or less. So we have genomics, we have transcriptomics, and we have proteomics, and we have metabolomics, and we have more omics, and we have more omics. So how you do this? Let me tell you a very brief story. Some time ago, I started working, since I came to Davis, I'm a pomologist, I have to work with fruits. So we decided to understand the molecular determinants for sugar-to-acid ratio in the fruit. Anybody growing fruits here knows that we are selling fruits. No, we are selling sugar-to-acid. That's what we sell. And that ratio is critical for when we harvest, when we store, the post-harvest process is a key process that determines the quality of our fruit. Of course, since Florence is here, there are also volatiles and there are other compounds. Of course, of course. She once told me we have more than sugar and acid, so I just remember. But essentially what we decided again, very empirically, okay, there are three stages of development, phase 1, 2, and 3, and you can see that during the development, acid goes down, sugar goes up. So we decided to study what happened. We are collaborating with people all over the world. A good friend of mine, Avi Zalka from Israel, he brought me a very interesting problem. That the breeders these days that are breeding new lemons, they have a problem. The lemons are not acid enough. And we say acid, we say very acid. Why lemons have to be acid, they ask. Well, it would appear that most of the lemons, really, we don't eat or drink. They go to the food industry. If you have a factory or a company and you want to acidify and you buy citric acid from the pharmacy, you will have to certify it. Millions of dollars. But if you put lemon juice, hey, no certification. You get a permit very, very fast because it's a natural product. No, it's very important. So the problem is the new lemons are more resistant for sickness and this and that, but they are not acid enough. So we decided maybe we can help. And we decided to do this experiment also with oranges because of logistical reasons. But essentially what we did is we took a stage, we isolated the Jussac cells, we isolated soluble in membrane-bound proteins, and we did mass spec, and we did a lot of omics, and more combinations, and more combinations, and more combinations, and then we end up with this. Now you are familiar with this, you know. There's a lot of experiments here. We have expression, we have enzymes, and we have metabolites. Now, one of the things that we found at a quite relatively early stage, that from fumarate or pyruvate, there is in citrus a pathway that was suspected but never shown, really. We just published it now. In the next slide, I will show you.
that produces citramylate. Citramylate is a compound produced in very, very low amounts in the fruit. But why citramylate is important? Because citramylate inhibits this step. Why this step is important? I go very fast. Because this step is the step that takes the citric acid out of the fruit to isocitrate. And the moment that this isocitrate, it's it. It's being used. This is like to have money in the bank. You go to the bank, you cannot spend the money in the bank. It's in the bank. That is citrate. The moment you go and you take the money out, dollars, isocitrate, now you spend it. And that's what the cells do. That is a way that they can use that for energy or catabolic processes. So what this enzyme does is citramylate does, at very low amounts, inhibits the enzyme aconitase that mediates this process. So we discovered this, and we have all the map, and this came because of all this metabolomic mumbo-jumbo and all these big experiments. I said, hey, we can do something. Let's synthesize some citramylate in the lab, and let's go spray the lemons. If some citramylate can go inside the fruit at the particular stage of development and stop this reaction, there will be more citric acid. The fruit should be more acid. And we did it. And that's what happened. And this is what happened in the field. This works. Then the problem is that we couldn't get any more citramylate, and then we didn't get funding, and then the boards didn't say no, but we are still doing it, at least with the guys in Israel. Citrus research boards didn't like the idea here, but the Israelis are using it a galore now. They're really having some effect on that. So this is a good example that why to know and integrate these omics can be useful. When we come with a bill and we tell you, you know, in order to do that, you're going to need X and Y dollars, don't get terrified. Because essentially, you are going to be there. But the more your knowledge, the more you know your genome to assign function and your proteome to know where your proteins are and your metabolite to know what direction are those reactions going, now you know what you want. And remember, if you're working with crops, well, each crop is different, like we are different. Okay, guys, they did the work. This is the list. Tzvi now is a professor in Israel. Maria is still in the lab. Rosa has her own lab in Spain. And Arkamal is now a professor in Lincoln, Nebraska. Ellen is our manager. Yasser came from Egypt. Carla, a professor in Brazil, just left. Yuval is coming to visit us tomorrow, but he has his own lab in Israel. These guys left now to graduate school, UC Jones Center, and is all the list of collaborators and the guys that at one time or another put some money in the work. Thank you very much. Good. Sorry, it's a very important slide. I forgot. Aha.
Thank you, Ed. You follow instructions well.
Yeah, I made it, you know.
All right, we have time for some questions, if there are any. Before we start, could all the graduate students raise your hand in the room? All right, I just want to know who to call on if there aren't any questions.
But if they don't ask, I am going to ask.
All right.
So you better ask. Come on, guys, I don't charge. Please.
Yes.
You probably got this question before, but so sucrose is up, proline is down, your transgenic plants. Any comments on how these plants are maintaining osmotic potential until under drought?
Oh, yeah. I have to do the experiment. The question is, are the plants osmoregulating? How they are doing it? If they are not using sucrose or any other osmoregulant, what they are doing?
So the first thing that we have to ask is, are these plants under stress? Because we find that they open the stomach, but there is a water deficit. Less, but they open it. There is some ABA, not too much. What's going on? And that is a conundrum. Because somehow, what these plants are doing are delaying the symptoms. They don't feel it. But the water potential is essentially low, but I didn't show the data. We know that osmotically, they are also feeling it different. The water potential in the plant, sorry, the osmotic potential in the transgenic plants is less negative by 15%, 13%. So there are two things here. First, they are not feeling it because they are somehow preserving water. How? We have an idea. I will tell you in a moment. But the second thing is they are very efficiently redistributing potassium and organic acids. So they are doing a mixture of things, like plants do. On one hand, they are very more efficient in redistributing potassium. We can see changes in HKT1, for example, HK1, all these potassium distributors in the plasma membrane in the vacuole, and the organic acids. One. But what happened with the water? So we are trying now to collaborate with Menachem Moshe Leon in Israel. He cloned all these water channels and have a wonderful system that he can do electrophysiology to see their behavior. We believe that the turnover of the channels is changing. That brings me to maybe a follow-up question. How the plant is doing on this? What is changing? Well, we have isolated few genes. I don't name them yet, but we know that all the balance between protein synthesis and protein degradation is changing. And we see those genes, very key genes, in regulating essentially protein stability. If you protect your proteins under stress, you don't feel the stress. That is what we believe is happening. Now we have to demonstrate.
Thanks.
Sure.
Microphone here.
I'm Randy. Did you identify specific nitrogen use efficiency genes that were upregulated in your transgenic plant? And were you able to identify the pathways that upregulated them, if yes?
Great. Good question. If you look at the question is, are there any typical NUE genes involved, nitrogen use efficiency genes? Well, we know if you see the direction of GDH towards to oxoglutarate, you are going to see that that is a way that the amino acid transferases work. But we don't see any of those going up terribly. And those are the traditional ones. How that connects with your conventional NUE genes? Here is how you look at the plant. From Arabidopsis, we like to see massive changes, 100%, 150%, 200%. But it happened that amino acid transferases are incredibly highly expressed compared to other genes. And they will escape any screen of 50% difference. So maybe there is 10 or 15% difference, but it's so abundant that makes a difference. So we are trying to analyze that. But I also believe there is a feedback mechanism. If you have a lot of amino acids, you are going to overload your reaction, but you have to bring them out. If your product is not being assimilated, the reaction will stop. This is the ABC of biochemistry. So there are a couple of enzymes that are never mentioned in an NUE problem, but I believe they are critical, which are the ones which are just downstream of the transferases. So hey, somebody want to put money in this, please, because that's what we should be doing. Yeah.
I had one question.
Yeah.
Cotton under drought, fiber quality is generally going to suffer. Will you have an opportunity to measure cotton fiber quality in your transgenic lines?
No, not yet. The truth is that we expected to do that in 2011 because all the experiments with cotton is really done, is our gene and our ideas, but because USDA is willing to help. We have no money to do it, no funds. So we have to wait for them. And 2011 was terrible. There were plants like this in the field. So we have to wait till next year. In principle, the balls look the same size-wise and weight-wise. I know that. They yield desire. But I don't know about the quality, because quality of cotton is a bit peculiar. It's not like the seed. You have to do processes. So I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I really don't know. We know about the quality of the peanut oil, and it's great. It's the same. There are no big differences. There's no oxidation. There is actually less in it. So the oil is great.
Any other?
Thank you very much.